All right. Well, thank you all very much for having me here. Can you hear me okay? It's too loud? All right. Excellent. Well, let me just say I am very, very impressed by Big Sky Worldview Forum. We're good to go? Excellent. I'm happy to identify myself as an evangelical. I'm raised an evangelical and evangelical today. One of the weaknesses of my tradition is that we tend to take a dualistic view of the faith, that Christianity's for what we do on Sunday morning, and maybe it provides some guidance during the week. We shouldn't have affairs or lie or cheat. But I think my tradition hasn't always done the best job of really thinking through what the reality of the Lordship of Jesus Christ over all of creation, what this really means for someone who might work as an attorney or someone who might work as a welder or for a father or for a mother or for a citizen. It's often easy just to go and not really think through the impact of our faith on these things. So as I look through the list of speakers, and I'm very honored to be included among them, I can see you all are addressing many of these things and helping people to think through how our faith would impact all we do. And I think it's just a great, great experiment. I wish every state had something like this. So what we'll do over the next 24 hours is talk largely about religious liberty. We're going to head that way. We're going to begin by spending some time in the American founding. Now, there's a number of reasons for doing this. As we'll see particularly tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court has absolutely insisted that we have to understand the religion clauses of the First Amendment in light of the founders' views. But I think the relevance of the American founding goes well beyond this. Politicians are routinely reaching back to the founders for evidence to support policy positions that they want to take today. A lot of what we'll talk about will involve religious liberty and church-state relations, but I think oftentimes the founders come into other conversations. As well, tonight we're going to begin with an interesting issue. This is probably the least immediately relevant to contemporary policy concerns, but I do think it raises an interesting question and it's something that should be of concern to people who are interested in worldview issues. What we're going to do is begin by addressing a myth that is very, very common. Now, I suppose a myth can be true, but this is a myth that is false. This is simply a falsehood, but is routinely said by academic after academic, by author after author who writes on the American founding. And that is basically that the American founders were deists. Now, I'm a professor, so I don't have a lot of money, so I can't collect a lot of things. So one thing I do collect is quotes. I've collected a lot of quotes on this issue from a multitude of authors, from some of the most prominent scholars in the land. Let me just read through a few of these so you know that I'm not attacking a straw person. So Gordon Wood, the Dean of American Historians, a longtime professor at Brown University, he writes, "The founding fathers were at most deist. They believed God created the world, then left it alone to run." Similarly, the recently deceased Edwin Gosted, one of the most prominent students of the history of religion in America, wrote, "The founding fathers themselves, largely deist in orientation and sympathy." We can read a few of these. Note the absolutist sort of language. The language is it's not some of the founders, but the founding fathers. Frank Lambert, a history professor at Purdue, writes, "The significance of the Enlightenment and deism for the birth of the American Republic, and especially the relationship between church and state, can hardly be overstated. The Enlightenment and deism." Richard Hughes, who teaches at a Christian college, Messiah College, writes that, quote, "Most of America's founders embraced some form of deism, not historically orthodox Christianity." Finally, and I have about 30 of these quotes, and these are all by prominent scholars, or I have a bunch by writers as well. I'm just picking on scholars tonight. So this isn't just someone who has a blog, who's writing whatever. Jeffrey Stone, a professor at the University of Chicago School of Law, writes that deistic beliefs played a central role in the framing of the American Republic. The founding generation viewed religion, and particularly religion's relation to government, through an Enlightenment lens that was deeply skeptical of Orthodox Christianity. Okay, so hopefully that gives you a taste of what is out there in many, many books. If you were to go to the your local library and get a book on religion, the American founding, it would be very likely that you would run across someone who's saying something to this effect. So what I want to do tonight is I want to explore how these authors make their case and how reading in a critical fashion should lead, even if you aren't an expert on religion and the American founding or the founding, just by reading critically the way they make their case, red flags should start waving. And one might say, hey, wait a minute, are they really offering the evidence to support their case? So how do they go about doing this? Book after book after book will do this. It will look at the religious views of Ben Franklin, George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Thomas Paine, Alexander Hamilton, and Ethan Allen. So about six or seven American founders. Now, you probably recognized all those names, and these are, in fact, important founders. But what the relationship between their religious views and the religious views of their colleagues is something that we're going to have to explore a little bit, and what their own religious views are we're going to have to explore. Again, you just have to take my word for it. All these books do this sort of thing. They rely on these people. They'll profile them one chapter in each one or this sort of thing. All right. Now, if we're going to start interrogating this claim, the founders were deists, one of the first things one would want to see is a definition of deism. Okay, what do you mean by deism? Deism very commonly is understood as sort of a clockmaker god. God created the universe, and then he walked away. He certainly doesn't intervene in the affairs of men and nations. This is a very common definition. It usually then it includes the idea that traditional Orthodox Christian doctrines, like the incarnation, the virgin birth, the Trinity, the divine inspiration of the scripture, we're just going to throw those all out. And particularly, I think one of the characteristics of deism is that God doesn't intervene in human history. So deists do believe in God, a creator God. They believe kind of in moral standards as well, but God certainly doesn't intervene in human affairs. All right, so given these clear claims, the founders were deists, what sort of evidence is there to support this? Let's just look at the views of a few of these founders. Let's begin with Ben Franklin. I am aware, let me just begin by giving away part of the story. There are about three founders that are clearly on record at some point of their life as rejecting some element of Orthodox Christianity. Ben Franklin is one of these. As a very young man in 1725, when he was over in England, he wrote an essay called Virtue and Vice, where he argued that there's no difference between virtue and vice. Now, that clearly is rejecting a basic tenet of Orthodox Christianity, Christians saying, yes, there's good, there's evil, there's virtue, there's vice. So he wrote this as a young man. And so there's evidence that at least as a young man, Franklin rejected at least one element of traditional Christianity. But do note, this doesn't necessarily mean he's a deist, because deists actually like morality. This maybe is suggesting something else. Even as a young man, though, Franklin recognized, you know, this is kind of a dangerous doctrine. I should be careful with this. And so he right away, he tried to confiscate as many of these essays, and he clearly repented of this. He clearly saw this was a bad idea. In his biography, he says, as a young man, I kind of played around with deism, but I've come to understand this is not a good idea. If we had more time, we could talk about the trajectory of his religious beliefs. Towards the end of his life, he seemed to be inching towards Orthodox Christianity, although he still had questions. John Witherspoon famously asked and said, do you believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God? And Franklin sort of humbly replied, well, I'm a very old man. I'm about to find out. He wasn't quite sure toward the end of his life. So the argument, do note what I'm trying to do here. I'm going through the evidence that could be presented to make the case that the founders were deists. With respect to Franklin, there is a piece of evidence that shows that, in fact, he rejected an element of Orthodox Christianity. All right, well, who are the other two that clearly rejected Orthodox Christianity, at least in some respects? Ethan Allen is a clear example of an American deist. Ethan Allen, the leader of the Green Mountain Boys, a hero for Fort Ticonderoga, and an advocate for a statehood for Vermont. In 1784, he published the first book advocating for deism, Reason, the Only Oracle of Man, probably co-authored with Thomas Young, a physician at the time. This book was, it fell dead born off the press. It only sold about 200 copies, almost, it had almost no influence. Even later deists or free thinkers who like Allen agreed this wasn't a very influential book. Particularly significant, though, for our purposes, after the publication of this book, Ethan Allen played no role in American history or politics. He faded from the scene, never really to be seen again. Thomas Paine is the other fellow who's clearly a deist. Tom Paine came over, wrote some great pamphlets, Common Sense and Otherwise, and others. But he said, I'm not even sure we should count him as an American. He, of course, is from England. He only spent about 20 of his 70 years in America. All the rest of the time was over in Europe. He came over, helped us win our war for independence, went back to Europe to help the French in the French Revolution. While in Europe, he wrote this book, The Age of Reason, which is clearly a deistic book. He's arguing for deism outright. But the telling thing, I think, is that when Paine came back to America, he was absolutely vilified because of this book. A number of founders responded very, very negatively to it. Sam Adams wrote a personal letter to him saying, you have to repent of this. John Adams, John Witherspoon, William Paterson, John Jay are all clearly on record criticizing this guy, saying this is a horrible work. It's a dangerous work. Benjamin Rush called The Age of Reason absurd and impious. Charles Carroll condemned Paine's blasphemous writing against the Christian religion. And the Connecticut juror Zephaniah Swift said, we cannot sufficiently reprobate the beliefs of Thomas Paine and his attack on Christianity. Two founders, Elias Boudinot and Patrick Henry, wrote book-length manuscripts to refute The Age of Reason. All right, so it might be the case. We could admit that maybe some founders found this attractive, but they didn't want to voice their support. But I would say that in and of itself tells us something very, very important about American political culture in the founding era. There were a few people who were fooling around with these deistic ideas, but they were vilified because of it. It was seen almost universally as a very, very bad way to go. All right, so now I want you to think about this in light of these very powerful claims. Most of the founders were deists. Of all the founders, I think I've only been able to find three who are clearly and publicly on record embracing anything like deism, the three I just mentioned. Now, we do know, let me hasten to say, we do know from their private writings that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams rejected some elements of Orthodox Christianity as well. Interestingly enough, they were very careful to keep these documents private. Usually they're letters that were written to friends, and Jefferson particularly would write private, do not share, all over it. And then sometimes he didn't even send those letters because they recognized it would be political suicide. They did not want their fellow countrymen to know they had questions about the Trinity or things of this nature. John Adams had a relatively minor lapse in his notes in the state of Virginia when he wrote that it doesn't really matter if my neighbor believes there's one God or three gods or 20 gods. What he meant by that is basically people who have different beliefs and even non-belief can be moral, and people who proclaim to be Christians can be immoral. That was simply his point. It's not necessarily something that would place him well outside the bounds of civilized society, but this comment came close to costing him the election of 1800. It was seen as an attack on Christianity, which is just something one doesn't do in this era. All right, so Jefferson and Adams. There are three other founders. Now, this is where things begin to get even more interesting, at least from my perspective. In all of these list of founders, Washington, Madison, and Hamilton are always included as deist founders. Now, here's what is mind-boggling to me. I have not been able to find a single place or a single time when any of these three in any way rejects any element of Orthodox Christianity, any tenet of Orthodox Christianity, not even one, all right? And, you know, these people wrote a lot of scholars have spent a lot of time looking at them, and yet no one has been able to show me. I've asked a lot of people, including friends, debating partners on the other side of these sorts of questions, friends that work on it with me. There just simply is no evidence that we have that they rejected any, the Trinity, the Incarnation, things of this nature. So what sort of evidence is presented? Well, oftentimes it's a sort of negative case. George Washington didn't use the phrase Jesus Christ very often, which is actually true. when he used providence all the time. He used God, he used Father, he didn't use Jesus Christ. Well, that doesn't make one a deist, all right? It is clearly the case that Alexander Hamilton had an extramarital affair, all right? And so therefore we know, what do we know? Well, he did something immoral, we know that. I'm not sure having an extramarital affair doesn't make one a non-Christian, and it certainly doesn't make one a deist, right? At the worst, I suppose, it's an immoral act that should be condemned, but it doesn't make one a deist. Sometimes secondary accounts are used. An Anglican minister recollected 20 years after Madison's death. He said, well, I met Mr. Madison one time, and in my conversation, I got the impression that his creed was not strictly regulated by the Bible. Well, that's sort of an interesting claim. I think we have to be real careful. A recollection 20 years after meeting someone that the creed isn't strictly regulated by the Bible, we should perhaps be pretty careful with that. Just as an aside, I'll mention that these second-hand accounts are always problematic. I generally don't use them myself, but if I were to use them, there are plenty of second-hand accounts that sing the praises of these very founders' piety. So, for instance, John Marshall, the great Chief Justice, wrote that Washington, who was chief of Washington's staff during the War for Independence, wrote that General Washington was a sincere believer in the Christian faith and a truly devout man. A Frenchman who knew Washington well said that every day of the year he rises at 5 in the morning. As soon as he is up, he dresses and prays fervently to God. And there's plenty of other accounts of this nature. Now, again, I'm not relying on them to make my case, but I'm just going to say that if we're going to use these secondhand accounts that might suggest something less in piety, we should counteract them with these sorts of accounts. All right, so... So what would you make of these? I can agree. I can look at Hamilton and say, yeah, Hamilton did something pretty immoral, very immoral, but that doesn't make him a deist, if that's what you're trying to claim. All right, now let me, before I proceed, make an observation. If you recall, we began this talk by defining deism. An important part of deism is that God does not interfere in the affairs of men and nations. If that is our definition of deist, then none of these seven men that I've mentioned, with the exception of Ethan Allen, are deist. All of them are clearly on record talking about God intervening in human affairs. George Washington is the easiest case here. He uses providence with the capital P in his writings more than 270 times. A good example, just for one, is 1755 letter to his brother when Washington was out in Ohio fighting in the French and Indian War, and there were reports that he had been shot. He writes, I have heard since my arrival at this place a circumstantial account of my death and dying speech. I take this early opportunity of contradicting the first and assuring you that I have not as yet composed the latter. But by the all-powerful dispensation of providence, I have been protected beyond all human probability. I had 4 bullets through my coat. 2 horses shot out from under me, yet escaped unhurt, although death was leveled at my companions on every side. This literally happened. 4 bullets through his jacket, 2 horses shot out. Do we know that it was God that was protecting George Washington? I'm not prepared to say I know that, but I can certainly say that George Washington attributed his protection to God, God intervening in human affairs. By definition, then, he's not a deist. John Adams routinely provoked providence as well, such as when he wrote to his wife, I must submit all my hopes and fears to an overruling providence, in which, unfashionable as the faith may be, I firmly believe. Jefferson, even Jefferson, who clearly rejected some elements of Orthodox Christianity, in his first inaugural address writes, may that infinite power which rules the destinies of the universe lead our counsels to what is best to give them a favorable issue for peace and prosperity. I've already mentioned Ben Franklin. Early in life, very, very skeptical. But towards later in his life, though, he did seem to mature. And it's even interesting that in what I'm about to read, he reflects on this himself. Listen to this. In the Constitutional Convention, when the delegates are at an impasse, Franklin, elderly Franklin, the oldest person at the convention, stands up and he says, in the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard and they were graciously answered. The longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth that God governs the affairs of men. So again, it's one thing to say as a young man, Franklin had heretical ideas, let's even call them that. He seems to have matured such that by the end of his life, he seems very comfortable with the idea of a God who intervenes in human affairs. His motion was seconded by Roger Sherman, an incredibly pious individual by all accounts. It ultimately did not pass because they were worried about the sort of PR flap this could make if they took a break from the convention to go and get a clergy. But nonetheless, I think this is a good example of Franklin seeming to embrace providence. James Madison, in Federalist 37, wrote that it's impossible for the man of pious reflection not to perceive in the Constitutional Convention a finger of the Almighty hand, which has been so frequently and seemingly extended to our relief in the critical stage of the Revolution. Alexander Hamilton, similarly, wrote shortly before his death to an unknown recipient, encouraging her to arraign not the dispensations of providence. They must be founded in wisdom and goodness, and when they do not suit us, it must be because there is some fault in ourselves which deserves chastisement, or because there is a kind intent to correct us in some vice or failing. Thomas Paine, I have a nice long quote from him. I won't read him in this quote, but basically he's talking about how God has blessed America and clearly has providentially intervened on our behalf. I'm not going to read it because I don't think he's serious, and I want to raise that as a possibility. I think we do need to acknowledge that some of these fellows might have just used the language of providence because it was politically expedient. But that in and of itself, again, tells us something about the political culture of the American founding. To make this case, you'd want to go founder by founder. I think for Thomas Paine, it's very likely he's just using it for rhetorical effect, maybe for Jefferson. But from my knowledge, the rest of them, I would say there's pretty good reason to believe that they actually did believe in providence, a creator God who intervenes in creation. All right, so if by deism we mean that some sort of notion that God set the world in motion, then abstained from human affairs, pretty much I think there's only one deist in the American founding, and that's Ethan Allen. Now, just think about this little journey that we've gone on so far. I began with a bunch of quotes by really prominent people saying most of the American founders were deists. By the time we examine the evidence that these authors present, we're down to one. That raises some interesting issues, I think. Let me, before I press on, it's great you had those quotes from the Declaration up, because some people use this as an argument for deism. They say, oh my goodness, the Declaration of Independence doesn't say Jesus Christ. It uses words like nature's God. That's an Enlightenment word. It's a deistic word. And so people say, yeah, you know, this sort of the supreme judge, the use of providence, first cause, and so forth, these are God words. They are not seriously Orthodox Christian words. Let me just say to you, this is nonsense. And if anyone spent any time reading texts from the era, they would know this. Let me just give you one example. The Westminster Standards. You're all familiar with the Westminster Standards, I trust, right? A classic Reformed Protestant statement of faith. In both its 1647 version and then in its 1788 version, the deity, God, is referred to as, quote, the supreme judge, the great creator of all things, the first cause, the righteous judge, God the creator, the supreme law, and king of the world. The standards regularly refer to God as providence. Isaac Watts, the founder of English hymnody, has a poem in which he refers to nature's God. Jeffrey Morrison has a very nice article where he says, look, the American founders, the American people would have understood intuitively what these words refer to, and it's not a vague deistic clockmaker God. It's a God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's how most Americans would have understood it. Thomas Jefferson, in the privacy of his own mind, might have been thinking about nature's God as nature, but that certainly isn't the case with most in the American founding. All right, so let me just even take a step back and make a lot of concessions that I probably wouldn't make in real life. Let's say we have a definition of deism that does, in fact, allow God to intervene in human affairs. And let's just kind of dismiss for the moment the bad evidence. I think it's bad evidence about Washington, Madison, and Hamilton. Let's actually say these six or seven men were deists. All right, so let's just stipulate for the sake of argument that Washington and Jefferson and Madison and so forth, that these seven men were deists. I think it'd still be very reasonable to say, are they representative of the American founders? And I'm going to suggest they're profoundly unrepresentative in a variety of ways. Washington, Jefferson, and Madison were all great plantation owners in the South. There just weren't a lot of great plantation owners in the South. Hamilton was born in Jamaica, raised down in the British West Indies, came to America as a young man. Thomas Paine, we already talked about, is from England, spent most of his life in Europe. These men are always included in our small sample here. In an era where virtually no one traveled internationally, Jefferson and Adams spent significant time in Europe. Ben Franklin spent over half of the last 35 years of his life in Europe. All right. Now, here's even, I think, the sort of most damning piece of evidence. By the end of their lives, six of these seven men were Anglicans or Episcopalians. Okay, they were Episcopalians. So that's 71% of our sample. In America at the time, only about 15% of the American people are Anglicans. So basically, if we want to write about the religious views of the American people or the American founders writ a bit more broadly, we want to go to a group that's all from the same religious tradition. Yet this is exactly what these scholars do. By way of contrast, according to Cindy Ahlstrom and Harry Stout both, about 75% of Americans in this era are reasonably classified as Calvinist. All right? Of our sample, only one, John Adams, is a Calvinist of sorts, a Congregationalist. He's a very bad Calvinist, but he's kind of from that tradition. 75% of Americans fall into this one category, and yet this category is almost completely neglected by students of this question, or by people who want to make this argument. So what I'm suggesting is this is a profoundly unrepresentative sample that we should be very careful in generalizing from. In this book on Roger Sherman, which was recently published, which Dick mentioned, we'll talk a little bit more about Roger Sherman in a later talk, an incredibly prominent founder, a very important founder, in some ways in 1776, far more important than some of these young bucks like Jefferson and Madison. So I spent a lot of time with him and a lot of his reformed friends, people like Samuel Adams, Elias Boudinot, Oliver Ellsworth, Matthew Griswold, John Hancock, Benjamin Huntington, Samuel Huntington, Thomas McKean, William Patterson, Tapping Reeves, Jesse Roots, John Treadwell, John Trimble, William Williams, James Wilson, John Witherspoon, Oliver Wolcott, Robert Yates. I know you might not know some of those names, even if you're a buff for the American founding, but I spent a decent amount of time with these. I want to say it seems every reason to believe these folks were pretty serious Calvinists, not just serious Christians, but serious Calvinists, and yet they're completely neglected in studies that want to make this sort of argument. Now, you might object, well, how do we know these 20 are representative of the American people? And I'm not claiming they are, but I would hazard that they're a lot more representative of their 75% of Americans in this era who are Calvinists than are Thomas Jefferson or some of these other Anglicans. As well, I would point out, if we looked at other Anglicans, if we looked at, say, a Patrick Henry, John Jay, or Henry Lawrence, we would find even among Anglicans, you have some really clearly godly, orthodox, Christian, pious founders who tend to be neglected in studies of this sort. All right, so do note what I'm arguing up to this point. My argument is not that the American founders, or even most of the American founders, were orthodox Christians. What I'm doing is I'm interrogating this very, very popular claim among academics and popular writers that most of the founders were deists, and I'm trying to suggest that there's virtually no evidence to support this, that really the evidence would suggest, if we use a strict definition of deism, that maybe there's one deist in the area, if we want to talk more broadly about founders that departed from some elements of Christianity, we could come up with a list that maybe would go on two hands, but it's hard to get much beyond that either. So these arguments are just profoundly problematic, I think. What are the conclusions? So here's where I hope to provide some thought. And I was thinking there might be more students. So as you're going off to college and you're being assigned books like this, how should one think about these studies as you're reading them? Should you just avoid going to college? Should you just avoid reading books, because you know there's this pretty powerful scholarly consensus that seems to be skewed in a particular direction. I would say that's not the answer at all, and I don't think any of you all probably think it is, right? That's why you're at a place like this. You want to read books, you want to engage in a wide range of literature, but one wants to do so in a critical fashion, right? To begin with, just think about the way this talk worked. You would not have to be an expert in the American founding to take a number of these steps. As you're reading through one of these books, is the author defining his terms? Does he define what deism is? Does he use this in a consistent fashion? Does the author provide evidence to support his assertions? In a number of these cases, they just simply don't. And one could recognize this as one is going along. Are these people, do I have reason to believe that they're representative of their fellow founders? And this might require at least going to Wikipedia or something like that to say, oh gosh, well, a bunch of them seem to be Anglican, and there weren't that many Anglicans at the time. Maybe they aren't representative. It would be obviously silly if I gave you a book arguing that African Americans today are Republican, and then we had a chapter on Ben Carson, and a chapter on Clarence Thomas, and a chapter on J.C. Watts, and a chapter on Michael Steele. I mean, these are all African American Republicans, right? But all of you know, of course, wait a minute. Those are completely unrepresentative. 90% of African Americans are Democrat. You're just putting together a book about five or six of the African-American Republicans. This clearly doesn't work. Let me do suggest as well that I think this is a particularly loaded issue because we'll go into this a little bit more later, but for good or ill, the founders' views matter with respect to religion and religious liberty, not so much whether they're deist or not, but their views of religious liberty and church-state relations, which we'll spend a lot more time with in the three remaining talks. But I think because of this bias, that there is a, because oftentimes these books do touch on these issues, there's an ideological motivation that might spin some of these authors to go in this direction. There's one other thing I'll mention, which I hesitate to mention, but again, it's something you might keep your eye open. It really frustrates me as someone who's spent 20 years working on religion in the American founding. This is one of those areas where it seems like other people who are otherwise good scholars think they can just kind of wade in and write on this subject without doing much work at all. So Jeffrey Stone really is a prominent law professor. He's far more prominent of a professor than I am. And yet all of his work is really like in criminal law and that sort of thing. And he just kind of gets it in his head that he wants to write in the American founding. So he goes and he reads a little Jefferson, a little Franklin, a little Adams. And he comes to the conclusion that most of the founders were deists. You see the problem there? He's not a subject expert. He doesn't. He hasn't spent a lot of time with the American founding. And so this is one thing to look at when you're reading a book of this nature. Do people have the sort of background and experience that one would want to see that would suggest they're experts in this area? Or is it something they're just, well, whip off a book on religion in the American founding that happens far, far too often? All right. So that, I think, is all I have for now. Let's see how we did for time. That is not too bad for time-wise, I think. So I think we have maybe 10 minutes or so. If there's questions, objections, if you want me to elaborate on anything, I went over some of this kind of quickly.
By the way, I had a local friend of mine, shall we say, who is a legislator, suggests that why would we be interested in what the founding fathers believe? And I thought to myself, no wonder the Republican Party isn't pro. Questions? If you have a question, it'd be nice if you'd come up here, because we are recording these, by the way. They are on our webpage. John Stone Street's lectures are on our webpage, and we have CDs available for those too.
I'm sure you're going to address this at some point later, so I don't want to steal your thunder, but what about these? We always hear the argument about the separation of church and state, and some of us know it's not anywhere in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, but it was in a letter that Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptist Association, but it's been blown way out of proportion. So if you're going to talk about that later, I don't want to steal it now, but if you're not going to talk about it later, could you address it?
No, that's an excellent question, and these things are wrapped up together oftentimes, and we will talk about it at great length later. Let me just say for now, point out a couple of similarities, all right, between the talk I just gave and what I'll talk about later. One is, how do you make an argument that the American founders desired anything approximating the separation of church and state? Basically, there are two men you can go to, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, and you have to ignore a lot of the stuff they actually did as president or governor or what they did in other contexts, and just rely on maybe four documents that they were involved with penning, on the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, the Memorial Remonstrance, the letter to the Danbury Baptist, and then the Detachment Memorandum. And you just look at these four documents, and you can kind of get some sense that they wanted a separation of church and state. So you have this exact same phenomenon. Judges and scholars who want to find the separation of church and state just keep going time and time again to these two men and these four documents. As we'll see, and as I suspect you already know, it's really pretty inaccurate to say that Jefferson and Madison's lives were characterized by any sort of pursuit of the separation of church and state. But I would stipulate this. They wanted a stricter separation of church and state than most of the other founders. But again, following the sort of logic of this talk, when you look at the other founders, the founders who actually wrote the First Amendment, Madison was involved, Jefferson wasn't, you'll see that most were very comfortable with the cooperation between the state and the church at the local level. Now, how exactly this plays out and how it should play out was a subject of debate even then. Just like many of us would probably be very uncomfortable having established churches today, some founders were coming to this conclusion as well. But why? Because it's bad for true Christianity. We don't want the government meddling with our churches because they'll mess our churches up. But that's very different than the sort of view that the ACLU and Americans United would have us believe, that there's some sort of principled commitment to building a wall of separation between church and state. Yeah, so almost no evidence that the American founders wanted this sort of outcome. And we will talk about it in detail later.
Maybe I'm getting off base here, but I want to ask you a question. What do you think of Carson's religion? Is that going to interfere or is that going to help him?
Oh, that's a great question. So the question is, what do I think of Carson's religion and what help him or hurt him? So I can't answer this question because I follow religion and politics more broadly. I don't just spend time in the American founding. I don't know if you meant specifically. Carson is a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which is basically a Protestant church with a couple of distinctives that aren't heretical breaks from Christianity. Carson is speaking, he speaks evangelicalism. He does it very, very well, and he's making great inroads among evangelicals. So people sometimes lump Carson and Trump together and say, well, these two outsiders, and they're pulling on this group of disaffected Republicans or disaffected people in general. That's really not true. They are two outsiders, but they're pulling on two very different groups. Evangelicals are flocking to Carson, not so much to Donald Trump. The real question, I think, is will this, will they be able to sustain this as questions come out about both of these men, as real live Republican voters have to actually show up at the polls and vote. My prediction is these outside candidates will fade, but I may be wrong about that. But then to take your question another step, beyond that, the Republican, the evangelical voters are a key to any Republican victory. So then someone like a Ted Cruz, I think, could make some real inroads there. He seems to be able to speak this language and address the concerns. Others can as well. Rubio, perhaps. Huckabee, if he's still in it. But yeah, the faith element is alive and well in this election. And this is nothing new in American politics. I mentioned in passing the election of 1800. The election of 1800, one of the huge debates was, is John Adams going to create a national establishment? That's what the Jeffersonians were saying, and this would be bad, this would be intolerant. On the other hand, Adams supporters were dinging Jefferson as a Enlightenment infidel, as a deist, and that sort of thing, throwing those as basically as curse words at him. So religion in American politics, nothing new at all.
It's my understanding that some of the evangelists that we had pre-revolutionary days, okay, like in the 1770s, I think George Whitehead was one,
yeah, yeah.
Right, are responsible for holding us together, you might say emotionally, to get us through the war, because we were not winning the war. And it was their influence that kept the American people willing to fight. Did they have an influence on these guys?
Oh, that's a great question. Whitfield, of course, is involved with the First Great Awakening, that great set of awakenings in the 1740s that rumbled through America. He was just a fantastic evangelist. He apparently, at Boston Common, if I remember correctly, addressing like 10,000 people without a microphone. I mean, this is just unheard of. And he was just blowing people away by his preaching or through the power of the Holy Spirit. There are scholars, very respectable scholars. This isn't exactly what you were asking, I think, but I'll just throw this out there, that draw direct connections between the First Great Awakening and the War for American Independence, pointing out that this awakening helped tear down traditional hierarchies. It really kind of lifted up the common man and validated the common person's experience, as sort of encouraging the sort of democracy and this idea that people can make a difference. And so you do. One of the great myths that's out there as well is that the American people were unchurched in the founding era. They talk about church attendance rates being very low, 15%, 20%. It's just false. This has been demonstrably proven to be false. It's hard to get the exact measure, but it certainly wasn't that low. These studies were based on things that any historian should have known better, but it was sociologists doing the studies. They were looking at things like joining churches, but some churches made it incredibly difficult to join. So you might have a lot of people attending a church that aren't actually members, and there's all sorts of other problems with the studies. And so in part, you could trace this back to the First Great Awakening. The religiosity of Americans clearly was a factor in holding themselves together. And then particularly some of the breakdowns of the religious leaders. So you remember me saying, according to Sidney Ahlstrom and Harry Stout, 75% of Americans in this era are reasonably categorized as Calvinist. The Calvinist clergy were almost uniformly on the side of the patriots. It's like 98% to 2%. The Anglican clergy, on the other hand, as you might expect, a church with the leader of the church being the King of England, was split about 50-50. But again, there's a lot more Calvinists than there are Anglicans, and these Calvinist clergy were key supporters of the War for Independence. And I'll even have a few quotes in later talk where the king seems to recognize this. And to this day, I taught a class once at Portland State, and a fellow from India was taking the class just for fun, and he came up and he said, "Do you know what we call the War for Independence in India?" I said, "No, what?" "The Presbyterian Rebellion." They did, because there was such an affiliation between these Calvinists and the Patriots. So I think, yeah, religious leaders did. Whitfield, of course, wasn't alive by the War for Independence. But, yeah, there are strong connections.
Well, you may not want to comment on this, but I was fascinated to again read about the Reformed political theory. And you talk about this book a little bit. Tell us the guts of what this thing says.
Sure, I would be happy to. And then I think we have a question over here. This book is Vindicae Contras Tyrannos by Stephanus Junius Brutus, A Defense of Liberty Against Tyrants. I actually am teaching an introduction to political theory this semester, and I had my students read excerpts from this. And I said, tell me any of the fundamental American political ideas that we think of, government by the consent of the governed, natural rights, the right to overthrow a tyrannical ruler. Book after book after book would say, well, these are Locke's ideas, John Locke's ideas, and Jefferson plagiarized Locke and this sort of thing. This book was written 100 years before John Locke wrote the Second Treatise, and I challenged my students, can you find any basically American political idea that is not in this? Government by the consent.
What's the date of this book again?
What's this? A Defense of Liberty Against Tyrants.
1579, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd have to check, but it's something like that. Yeah, so these Reformed Christians, these Calvinists, John Calvin, people sometimes get a little misled because they just looked to Calvin. Calvin has a theory of revolution. He says basically if the king is bad, maybe inferior magistrates could check the king, but the people certainly can't, okay? And so that's, you know, that's actually more radical than most of what you have in this era, but it's not as radical as the sort of language we were using in America in 1776. But even as Calvin was writing this, John Knox was up in Scotland saying, no, the people themselves can rise up and overthrow a tyrant. And the author of Windicke is somewhere in between on this, that, you know, maybe the people, but certainly it helps if you have leaders and whatnot. The point is, the simple point is, and part of the argument of Roger Sherman in the creation of the American Republic is you have this strain of Calvinist political thought that has been largely neglected by scholars that I think has a tremendous influence on many, many of the founders, particularly those that are reasonably classified as Calvinists, the Congregationalist Presbyterians.
I just wonder if you could kind of flesh out more some about the religious views of Thomas Jefferson, because from what I've read, you know, I don't know if he's classed as a deist, but it sounds like he was a long way from Orthodox Christianity. That I know that he has this Jefferson's Bible where he cuts out all the miracles and kind of regards miracles as mythological. I mean, was that his consistent view, or maybe you could just flesh that out a bit?
Yeah, no, this is a great question. Thomas Jefferson, we know from letters written later in life, after 1810, clearly rejects numerous basic elements of traditional Orthodox Christianity. The incarnation, miracles, the Trinity, the atonement. I mean, he's clearly on record as rejecting these. So there's no doubt at all that as a mature adult, Jefferson is not an Orthodox Christian. He's very, very heretical. This does not make him, and I hope no one heard me trying to argue that he was a Christian, but I'll still say this does not make him a deist, right? Still someone who rejects all these things can still believe in a God that can intervene in human affairs. But at the end of the day, I actually won't fight anyone over that question. You want to call Jefferson a deist? Fine. There's good reasons for doing so. And so between Jefferson, Ethan Allen, Thomas Young, Thomas Paine, maybe you can come up with four deists from this era. As a young man, it's hard to get a real grasp on him. And some people speculate that when he lost his beloved daughter somewhere around 1800, I think it is, that this might have kind of driven him from Orthodox Christianity. I just don't know how to describe Jefferson as a young man.
My understanding, and you may have a comment on this, is that John Adams continued to write letters to him. I think they died on the same day.
They did, yeah.
And continued to challenge him about more orthodox things, although Adams himself wasn't what we would call completely orthodox.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so, but he was, I think, more orthodox. And John Quincy Adams actually kind of wrote letters to his dad trying to encourage him to become more orthodox. So it's true. So if I can just take a step back and say this, if probably my biggest objection to these scholars is they use words like most of America's founders were deist. This is just patently false, or at least we certainly don't have the evidence to show this. So a lot of my projects just showing that this is false. There's just no good reason to believe this. If I wanted to make their case, I would probably say something like, some of America's most influential founders rejected elements of Christianity and might have even been deist. And then you could focus in on Franklin and Adams and Jefferson and try to make that case. But I suppose my response to that would be, wait a minute. There are lots of people involved in the American founding, and you know, when we want to talk about the meaning of the Declaration of Independence, we can't just talk about Thomas Jefferson. There is a committee of five. We don't know how exactly that committee worked. Then ultimately, of course, there was a group of 56 or so men that revised and approved this thing. If we want to know what the authors or what the framers of the Declaration meant, we have to look at the constellation of founders, not just one person, not just Thomas Jefferson, you know, all 56 of them. And then we start talking about the Constitution. It's even more complicated, so we have 55 men in Philadelphia, But they, of course, can't do anything but propose. The Constitution then goes out to ratification conventions, where you now are literally up into the hundreds of people involved in approving this document. When we expand the scope, we see that the views of a Jefferson, the views of a Adams on theological issues are just completely unrepresentative. And this, again, this is kind of high-level theory, but I think this is true on some other things, such as religious liberty, which we'll get to later, or church-state relations specifically.
Excellent start. We're going to take 10 minutes and...